Welcome to the Diabetes What to Know podcast, where we talk to diabetes experts about how to live a long, healthy life with diabetes. We have a very special episode for you with clinical pharmacist and certified diabetes educator, Sarah Kwan, answering questions about diabetes medications, blood sugar levels, and more. Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us.
It's great to be here with you.
So I'd like to start with a few questions we hear from a lot of folks about medications. First, what is the difference between generic diabetes medications and branded medications? Are branded medications better than generic ones?
I think people have to remember that both brand and generic medications have the same active ingredients. So the difference may be the packaging, the coating, the coloring, the binders that put the medication together, and the film coating. But the generic and brand medications both are FDA approved to have the same active ingredients. When the brand manufacturer brings it to market, they have a patent on it for a certain period of time. And then when that patent runs out, then the other drug companies can make that same drug and it becomes a generic drug that's available at often a lower cost available to the patients.
So another question, is there a particular category of diabetes medicines that are the best? And if so, why?
Overall, we need to look at individualized treatment therapy for people and a lot of different considerations. So what may be best for one person may not be the best for another individual. Like, for example, if you have a person with A1C way high, with blood glucose averaging in the 200-300s, versus someone who has just been diagnosed with blood glucose with A1C that is like an 8%, with blood glucose ranging in the like 140s, 150s, the target to get them down to goal is quite different. And also individuals have other maybe different comorbidities. Maybe they have kidney disease. Maybe they have cardiovascular disease. Maybe they have heart failure. And all of those things kind of play into selecting the drug that might be best for the individual.
So you mentioned injections earlier. If someone watching is very hesitant to start an injectable, what would you want them to know?
I know there's a huge barrier and feeling of utilizing insulin, which is actually the most effective drug for diabetes. We need to just have you keep an open mind. And one of the surprising things that people will encounter after the first tutorial is that when you administer subcutaneous injections with a tiny needle, you almost don't feel it because we actually administer it on the kind of the fatty tissues of their body and where there's less nerve endings. So like when you pinch a little bit of stomach and then you inject it in their abdominal area, your arms and your thighs that are fatty, when you pinch that area and inject, you almost are surprised at how non-invasive it feels. So I think the technique and the tutorials and administration, that's something that you're going to be taught when you are starting an insulin injection or a GLP. So those are the things that I think people are apprehensive about, that they can actually, once they start the administration and once they get the tutorial, once they do their first injection, it's going to be surprising how non-painful or non-invasive than what you might already have thought.
And we've heard that from a lot of folks as well. You know, they were very nervous about it. They thought it was going to be very painful. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out not to be a big deal. But I am glad you called out specifically making sure you're getting trained on it by the nurse in the doctor's office or a diabetes care and education specialist, because technique can make a big difference, right?
Absolutely. I think how you are shown how to use the injections is going to make it so that, when you overcome the barrier, and once the person sees how successful they can do it, they will feel much more confident in their own techniques and administering and, utilizing that effective drug.
Okay, Sarah, another question we hear frequently is, will I have to take diabetes medicines forever? What would you say about that?
Well, once you are diagnosed with diabetes, the disease and the age progression will likely require you to take medications for optimal control. But there are individuals that have completely reduced or come off medications with the lifestyle changes that they have implemented in terms of the food choices, in terms of activities, and leading to weight loss, those things have stayed off the onset of diabetes. So once you're diagnosed with the requirement for blood glucose management. But again, the progression to needing more and more medications could be mitigated or slowed down by what you do and the choices that you make.
So many people have kind of getting off of medication as their goal, and they think that that's what being healthy with diabetes means. Is that true? What would you want them to know about that?
I think once you're diagnosed with diabetes, again, you have the predisposition so that your blood glucose needs to be managed, whether it is your body not making enough insulin or your body resisting to the insulin that it's made, that it's not metabolizing the glucose correctly. When you are diagnosed with diabetes, you may be able to come off of medication therapy, but again, it is a disease that progresses along with age. So most likely you will need some sort of medications to optimize your therapy down the line. But initially, you may be with those individuals who could control it with the lifestyle alone.
So what I hear you saying is it's really our blood sugar that matters, what our numbers are. And if we need medication for that, that's no big deal. It's keeping the numbers where they need to be. That's really the most important thing.
Yes, I would agree. Objectively, if we could keep the blood glucose numbers near normal or normal, it would be as if you do not have diabetes, and the long-term complications are then mitigated or delayed.
Ah, great point. Very inspiring. We get a lot of questions about metformin, so let's tackle those next. First and foremost, is metformin safe? Some people reported seeing commercials saying it was dangerous and that had them concerned. Is it a safe medication?
It is still the gold standard. Metformin came out actually when I was starting to do diabetes education. It's been around for about 30 years, and it is one of the most effective drugs that we have. And it's also, there's benefits. It doesn't have a tendency for hypoglycemia. It doesn't have tendency for weight gain. And the cost effectiveness also promotes it to be one of the top drugs that are implemented when you're diagnosed with diabetes.
So what are the side effects? We've heard people complain about them. What are they and how long do they last?
So one of the things that we as pharmacists counsel the patients when they're starting on metformin is that it is very common that you're going to have the nausea, the vomiting, and some diarrhea. It's all GI related. And it has that as a very common side effect. But depending on how we start it in the lower dosage that we start at and titrating it up slowly, it is much tolerable for most individuals. Now, there's a small population that still can't tolerate it. And if you have a history of GI intolerance and sensitive stomach, we start out with lower dosage, but we titrate it slowly, increasing the dosage at like 500 milligrams, increasing it every 2 weeks, every month. Start with a low dosage and go slowly. And most individuals tolerate it very well.
So two things I hear you saying. One, if we're having some side effects, we definitely want to be talking to our doctor about maybe adjusting our dosage, going to a lower dose until our system acclimates. Second, should we be exploring the extended release formulation? That does that help mitigate some of the side effects as well?
I think it may have that impact, but I think it's starting again once with the lower dosage, 500 milligrams, not 1,000 milligrams. And some individuals, they start out as low as 250 milligrams. The slow titration is the key, allowing body to get used to the medication and then taking it up in a course of weeks to a month. And this is a long-term medication. So that is probably the most important part of the tolerance to that drug.
So several people wanted to know why metformin smells like fish. They say the smell can make it hard to swallow. Any ideas on why that is and what we can do about it?
I think the chemical nature of metformin gives off the odor or the fishiness. And so right now, there are many different manufacturers of that medication. And sometimes the extended release, sometimes different manufacturer has like a lower odor So if you could change it from a different manufacturer, that might help mitigate the problem. And also, if you could take it with food, that helps to, you know, it's a large pill. That helps to make it more tolerable for the medications to be ingested.
Okay, Sarah, one person asked, my doctor just told me that I have insulin resistance. What can I do about that?
One of the best things to improve insulin sensitivity is modest amount of weight loss. Physical activity, if you could stand more and less sitting, the large muscles in your body could help improve the glucose metabolism. Another a fact that might help insulin resistance is changing some of the choices in the foods. When you consume carbohydrates that are highly processed, like rice and bread and white flour, all of those things could peak and spike your blood glucose. When you spike your blood glucose, it takes a little bit longer time for your body to bring it down. And that spike glucose promotes more insulin resistance. So changing of nutrition can help kind of mitigate that issue.
We also got a few questions about insulin. First question, someone wanted to know, do you have to keep insulin refrigerated?
Yes. Unopened bottles of insulin vials should be refrigerated. And if you are taking it out of the refrigeration for administration, it's good for use out of the refrigerator at room temperature for about a month. I think 28 days, it has good stability. However, if you are keeping the unopened bottles, it should be refrigerated for stability.
So someone asked on our page last night, it stings sometimes when I give myself a shot. Is there any way to prevent that?
Yes, there are probably a couple of different reasons why that might be occurring. If you are cleaning and swabbing the area before administration of insulin, you got to make sure that alcohol evaporates completely and it's dry before you pinch the skin and administer the insulin. Also, when the insulin is brought straight out from the refrigerator and it's really cold, that could also cause a sting. And if the insulin is administered closer to the muscle, closer to the vessels, that could definitely have a sting. And you want to administer it subcutaneously in the parts of the body that have a little bit of fatty cushion and padding. I think most of us can find that.
So we also had a few questions about blood sugar and checking blood sugar. Several people asked, should I be checking my blood sugar daily on my own?
That is an excellent question. I would say that going to your doctor once a year, twice a year, and if you're very frequent, four times a year, having the blood glucose checked, fasting blood glucose, hemoglobin A1C is not enough. You have to remember that adults with pre-diabetes, there's 1 in 3 people with abnormal blood glucose walking around. And I believe there's 1 in 5 that have a full-blown diabetes that do not know that they have high blood glucose. So checking and monitoring your blood glucose is something I advocate. I myself check blood glucose every month for a period of 2, 3, 4 days so that I can know my own pattern. So I check my blood glucose at the end of the month, either before bedtime, before dinner meal, after large pasta meal, before breakfast, so I could understand what my own pattern is. My blood glucose levels are not in the range that is diabetes. However, oftentimes my fasting blood sugar is over 100, and that is the range in the gray area where you are pre-diabetic. And so again, 1 in 3 adults have abnormal blood glucose. And until you're diagnosed, which takes years, 5, 6, 7, 8 years maybe in the average, by that time, you may also have neuropathy onset even before the full diagnosis of diabetes. So checking your pattern, knowing your pattern, preemptively checking if you have family history of diabetes and you are overweight, because they go kind of hand in hand, to know your pattern before you are diagnosed is imperative.
And if we have been diagnosed, it's even more important to be checking on a regular basis so we have an idea of what's happening.
Absolutely. If you have been diagnosed with diabetes, make sure that you have a blood glucometer, and oftentimes they're covered by insurance. But even if it's not, it is really affordable. Over the counters, they cost about $20, and some blood glucose meters, even the strips, are very much affordable. You get a bottle of 50 for like $8 to $10. If you could start managing your diabetes by understanding what your blood glucose pattern is, then you could actually have real data when you go back to your doctor's office to say, this is my blood glucose pattern, these are my numbers. And then your provider and your physician, your practitioner could really be involved in making sure that the type of medication and dosage could be correctly adjusted to what you need.
So speaking of someone who's monitoring their numbers regularly, we had a person in the group say, I'm getting nervous. My morning numbers have gone up from being usually in the 130s to now being in the 150s, and I'm not sure what caused the change. What are some things you might suggest they explore?
So there are many possible reasons that might be. If the individual is snacking late at night, that could contribute to higher numbers. If an individual is actually going low, let's have low blood glucose in the middle of the night, that could prompt your body to release glucose to make it so that it's higher in the morning. There's also another thing. We have this dawn phenomena where we release all the hormones so that our body wakes up. That could cause a little increase or a boost to our blood sugars in the morning. So one of the things you might check is that in the middle of the night, 2, 3 a.m., check your blood glucose. If it is low, the reason why your morning sugars are high is because your body is responding to that.
Oh, great suggestion. Last question from me, Sarah. You're a pharmacist and you've shared such great information here with us tonight. What should people with type 2 diabetes be talking to their pharmacist about?
You could ask your pharmacist about your drugs that you are taking for diabetes management and other conditions, but really strategizing with them. What do you think may help me improve my diabetes management? And pharmacists are more than willing to help kind of address that problem and issue of disease management, and not just drug information and drug management. So I would promote that idea of going to the pharmacist and say, hey, what would you recommend? I want to manage my diabetes better. What are the strategies that you would recommend?
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This has been such a helpful conversation.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to share, and I hope and wish you the best.
We will be back to you with a new episode in a few weeks. Until then, please stay safe and take good care. Good night.